This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. This is a show about craft, the writing life, and the themes that are present in a writer's work. Every interview is a journey. I don't really know where our conversation is going to go, but I do know that it's fascinating every time, and one way or another, we seem to get around to what it means to be human and how through craft that idea is articulated on the page. Thank you for joining me on this literary pilgrimage into the mind of one writer at a time. My interview today is with Maggie Smith, author of the memoir, You Could Make This Place Beautiful.
You know, there are all these formal devices that we can use as writers to make ourselves more comfortable, I think, handling hot material.
We'll be back with Maggie Smith after these essential words. First, I want to say thank you for listening. The episode you're about to tune into represents 9.5 years of weekly interviews with writers on craft and the literary life. This interview is one piece of an archive of more than 380 conversations that go into depth about how writers create their work and the subject matters that obsess them. And that's why I'm asking you to please support First Draft, a dialogue on writing on Patreon. You can find out more at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. When you donate to First Draft, you are joining the community of writers and readers who support conversations like the one you are about to hear. You are the scaffolding that holds up this platform that is committed to sharing the insights and challenges of the writing life. And let's be honest, there is so much free content out there. In fact, what you are about to listen to is free to you, but it is not without expense to me in hard costs and in labor. Don't get me wrong, producing these interviews is a labor of love, but all told, from scheduling, preparation, reading time, interviewing, editing, and finalizing each episode, we're talking about a minimum of 15 hours an episode. There's also equipment and subscriptions to interview platforms and sound transcripts and editing software and hosting services for the sound and a website for the archive. And those things added up are not cheap. And all of this whole entire colossal effort, takes a lot of heart and sweat to come to fruition every week. And please understand, I am the entire show from start to finish. I am the editor, the interviewer, the reader, the researcher, the staff. Sometimes the staff doesn't perform as well as I'd like, but I am the only person performing. So why not consider supporting a woman with a dream to share literary wisdom from some of the world's best writers in a podcast platform? I would say with the number of episodes I've produced, which is actually more than in the archive, so more than 400, my track record is pretty stellar. And please beat the odds of having to listen to this message 7 times before you join the First Draft community. Go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. As a thank you, my patrons receive access to cuts from the interviews that didn't make it into the final show, ad-free, pitch-free episodes, and writing tips from my guests. You can become a supporter by going to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. That's patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Any amount is welcome, but for $6 a month, you receive thank you gifts on a monthly basis. Please stay tuned at the end of the show. I'll offer recommendations on an episode in the archive that is similar to the one you're about to hear. And please rate the show on iTunes and tell everyone you know to subscribe. And thank you mostly for listening and for being here with me today, right now, in this moment, and on to the show. My interview today is with memoirist, poet, and nonfiction writer Maggie Smith. She is the author of 9 books, including national bestsellers Goldenrod and Keep Moving, Notes on Loss, Creativity, and Change, as well as Good Bones, named one of the best 5 poetry books of 2017 by the Washington Post and winner of the 2018 Independent Publisher Book Awards Gold Medal in Poetry. Smith is the recipient of a Creative Writing Fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts and has won 2 Academy of American Poets prizes. In 2016, her poem Good Bones went viral internationally and was covered by the Washington Post, The Guardian, Post Italia, and other publications. It has been translated into nearly a dozen languages, and Public Radio International called it the official poem of 2016. Her new memoir, You Could Make This Place Beautiful, is told in vignettes that explore the disintegration of her marriage and her renewed commitment to herself. She begins the book with her personal heartbreak and the betrayal she experienced, and contemplates the wider notions of womanhood, independence, motherhood, forgiveness, and narrative. You Could Make This Place Beautiful interweaves personal narrative with existential questions, memories, and arguments for hope and regeneration. We began the discussion with me asking Maggie Smith this question. You have a beautiful epigraph from Emily Dickinson, and I've never read it before. And it says, I am out with lanterns looking for myself. And I felt as I was reading this, in some way, this was a guiding principle for your book. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about, I don't know if you remember when you first read this line, but why you chose it.
Yeah, I don't actually remember the first time I encountered the Dickinson line, but and it didn't actually predate the writing of the memoir. So I was working on the book before I found the epigraph. And sometimes that happens. You stumble across something and it's like, oh, that doesn't need to be a quote in the book. That needs to be the sort of umbrella quote for the whole thing. That needs to be the welcome mat quote, right? At the very beginning. And it was the sort of guiding principle I wanted the reader to keep in mind going into the book. I think because to me, poetry always does this thing, even for me as a poet, when I read someone else's line, it encapsulates or articulates something that I don't quite have language for. I mean, that's why I go to poems, for that click, that little spark of like, oh, yes, that's exactly what it is. I hadn't thought to phrase it that way. And so I knew, kind of traveling into this memoir and telling these stories and trying to sort of find myself in it, was going to be kind of like traveling into the dark, traveling back into a dimmer lit space. And so I loved this idea of being out with lanterns, like carrying light with yourself while you're looking for who it is you are. And I don't know about you, but I find that myself and a lot of people I know hit a certain age and are like, well, how did I get here? Like what choices, what decisions, what paths taken or not taken to bring frost into it? What sort of led me to be where I am in my life, who I am in my life? How do I sort of reckon with that? And so this writing experience and then that epigraph kind of, I think, encapsulate the curiosity that I went into this project with.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting that it wasn't there for you from the beginning, which kind of leads me to ask you a little bit about the structure of the book. And I understand how you could weave something like that in later because it feels so overarching, but the structure of your book are almost like these little vignettes, or you have pages mm-hmm. where you just are trying to answer a question, or you have areas where you include poetry, or you have kind of like deeper thoughts in italics. So just curious about the structure, and maybe for you, it does relate really closely to poetry. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think I enter every writing project as a poet. Like, I don't know how to write anything except for as a poet. That's my home genre. That's sort of my territory. So whenever I write anything, whether it's an essay or a poem or a story or probably an email, I'm writing it as a poet. And so when I approach a writing project, the thing I'm thinking of, and I do this with poems too, is what form is going to best embody or enact the content? Like, here's the content. Here's the sort of experience or thought that I'm bringing to this piece. Now, what form is going to best kind of bring the reader into that experience? And so for this memoir, I knew that vignettes would be probably the right way to do it. A, because I'm a poet and I'm comfortable writing small. I'm a whittler. So when I start writing something, my impulse is always to make it smaller. I'm always looking for places to trim away connective tissue, cut fat, like boil it down, only sort of get to the most essential pieces. So as I revise a piece of writing, it almost always shrinks. It usually doesn't grow in size and scope. And so as a poet, I knew probably it would make the most sense for me to do it as myself, which would be to write small over and over again, rather than try to think about it as big from the outset. And then the other thing is that, you know, memory is associative. We don't remember in a straight line, like a history textbook timeline, where this happened and then this happened and this, then this happened. So when you remember something, it sort of pings, or it's more of a constellation shape or a web, right? And it reminds you of this other thing over here, which then might ping and remind you of this other thing over here. And so the vignettes and the sort of threading to me felt like the most psychologically true form for what it feels like to both remember different parts of your life and also kind of ruminate, you know, because ruminating and thinking about things and processing things and grieving, those things don't happen in a straight line either. They happen in like spirals or circles or waves. And so trying to find the shape that the reader would not just hear the story, but would feel the experience, that was kind of how I came to the structure.
You know, for people who haven't read it, they might envision from what you just said that it's all these random vignettes, but it is not random at all. It's very, you have kind of also like repeating, like almost like choruses throughout the book. I know you love music. So you have an area where you come back to this idea of plot many times and what is plot. And you have an idea where you come back to your life as a play and you call yourself the finder. And you have elements where you come back to this question that I want to talk to you more about, is like, what is the unanswerable question about this memoir? So you do have these snippets, but there's also like a larger shape to it.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yes. I mean, I'm glad that you got that. It really did entail for me braiding a lot of different strands, and putting it together was not that different for me from putting together a poetry manuscript, which is, I tend to print everything out, lay all the pages out, like on my living room floor. And then I color coded the different strands literally with markers. So if the unanswerable questions were a strand, say they were pink, and then maybe the italicized sort of playing with metaphor might have been blue, and then the forward narrative might have been green, and the quotes from other writers might have been yellow. And so I could kind of leaf them together, maintain the structure of the narrative going forward, because I wanted the reader to have an anchor and not just be bouncing around. You're right. And then I wanted to make sure that each strand stayed fairly consistent and didn't drop out for too many pages. So if I noticed that pink was gone for 30 pages in a draft, I would go back through and be like, nope, I've got to work that strand in, because I do want it to feel really tightly woven. So that was actually great. It was a huge challenge of kind of Tetrising the book together, but it was also great sort of mathematical fun for a poet.
What was it like when you very first started it? I mean, the impetus for this book is, I guess, the downfall of your marriage, that you discovered that your husband was having an affair, which kind of made you look at something bigger and like, how has our relationship truly been? And that's so emotional. And your book is so crafted. So I'm curious, in the very beginning days, how, not that you had to, but how did you start writing and control all these feelings to get it to where it is now?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I didn't begin writing the book in the middle of all of that sort of discovery and processing. So there was not a ton of distance, but there was some distance between, you know, living the events themselves and then writing about them. Later in the book, a lot of that was sort of being written closer to when it happened. But the initial scenes, I needed a year or two to kind of wrap my head around those. And, you know, some of the strands that you're talking about, like the play and like the discussion of plot and some of the like actually talk, breaking the fourth wall and talking to the reader, some of those sort of craft moves for me enabled me to write the more difficult parts, because they allowed me to create a little bit of distance between me, the person, and what was happening in the book.
So you start the book with this image of a pine cone. It's kind of, I mean, it's both an image and a real object. It's an artifact that is very symbolic, because your husband brings it home for your son on a trip that he turns out that he was with this other woman. And the pine cone is where the reader kind of gets anchored and starts the book with learning about this pine cone, and that it's not like this pure thing from nature. It's tainted. So curious how you landed on that.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's sort of where the story begins. And I talk about it in the very beginning of the book. I'm sort of like, where the story could start in many different places. And for anyone who's tried to sort of write memoir or even write a personal essay about a time, there are lots of openings or potential openings, right? A lot of different places where a story could begin. And to me, maybe in part because I'm a poet and I like to work with image and metaphor and symbol, that beginning with that felt like the right place to me. But I mean, I'm fairly open in the book that it could have begun in a lot of different places. And ultimately, you just have to make a choice, the same way with how a book ends, right? Like, how a book ends is up for grabs. And it could have ended a lot of different ways, because it's a book and not a life, right? So the book ends and the life continues. That's the tricky thing about memoir. When a novel ends, the story kind of ends. And you might imagine what those characters might continue doing if the author kept writing about them, but they don't exist. In a memoir, the book ends and we all put it down, but the living continues. Those people aren't characters. And so trying to decide where to sort of like trim the story from beginning to end was one of the challenges that I think is a challenge that faces all of us who write about ourselves.
Yeah. And I'm sure for many writers, it's really hard to sleep at night because there's no answer. It's not like, like when you took a test in elementary school and the answers were in the back of the book.
Yeah. Unfortunately, no. Yes. I actually worked for a while in educational publishing. And so part of my job for a while was writing the answers at the back of the book. And so knowing, I think, appeals to all of us. It's why plot appeals to all of us. Like, we are storytellers by nature. We want answers. We want wholeness. We want to understand things. And life doesn't always offer that to us, right? And so I think, even kind of tying back to the epigraph, you know, one of the ideas I think in this book is that other people will always be in part a mystery to us. We don't actually have access to the interior of anyone else. We can only ever know ourselves and speak for ourselves. And so one of the things that I can do for myself, at least, is to not be a mystery to myself, right? To get to know myself well enough to have enough self-awareness that I can make the best choices for me, for my kids, for my writing, in my own, you know, other relationships, even though I don't have, quote, all the answers or any control over what anybody else does.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Well, one of the things you do several times throughout the book is you talk about sort of your future self. You mention, like, in one part, you're saying, by the time you're reading this sentence, I want to have let go. And there's another place where you're saying, I want to be in a place of forgiveness when this book is out in the world. And that time is now. And yeah. I'm curious how you feel about those things.
You know, I think I landed in a place of acceptance, which I think is sort of texturally and maybe even sort of temperature wise, a little bit different than what we think of as forgiveness. But acceptance is where I've landed. And to me, that's like a good enough space where I feel like I've healed enough. Not because I've gotten all of the answers or everything I needed from anybody else, but because I've gotten enough answers from myself and sort of peace within myself, which I can control, right? Like that's the peace that I can control. Isn't that what we always hear, right? Like you can't control anyone else's behavior, but you can control your reaction, or you can't control what happens to you, but you can control your response. And so I think one of the big sort of healing pieces of the writing of this book was seeing myself in a new way and seeing some of the decisions that I made even like earlier in life, in my 20s and my teens and my 30s, in a new way, and being able to show myself compassion and even forgive myself. Like that's a big piece of this. It's not just being able to forgive other people for the ways that you feel they may have wronged you. It's about forgiving yourself for maybe not doing things differently yourself, right? Because every relationship is co-created. Like every family system, every work relationship, every friendship, every parent-child relationship, we make that together. It's not, you know, visited upon us. And so the best thing I could do for myself to get to a place of acceptance was really reckon with not other people, because that's not how you heal. It's reckoning with myself.
One of the things throughout the book you are wondering what to do with is your wedding dress. And I'm curious if you still have it.
I do. It's still in my son's closet. I haven't done anything with it yet. I actually still have my rings. And I haven't decided what to do with them. I think maybe this might be the year. Now that the memoir is coming out, like it might be time to sort of have some kind of symbolic something with them. But it hasn't hit me yet. So they're still artifacts in the house. I like the idea of having like a symbolic letting go. I mean, I wrote about that. Like what would happen if I went to all the places that were sort of important to me during that relationship and left a scrap of the dress until it was gone, like just left a piece of it in all of these places, almost like scattering ashes, right? Like where people wish to be. I didn't do it. Like I thought maybe I'd take it on a road trip and just kind of rip it up and leave it in meaningful places. And maybe I still will. I mean, actually, I think that might be a kind of cathartic adventure to have at some point.
It sounds fun.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, who knows?
It's definitely, it's like both an excavation and a letting go.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, in some ways, that's exactly what this book was. That feels right to me. Like an excavation as a way of letting go. Like, let's just dig it all up. Let's look at it with clear eyes, turn it over in our hands, look at all the facets, know it as well as we can, and then set it down.
If only your wedding dress could drive and you can look out the window.
Oh, I would love. Yeah, we'll do a self-driving car and we'll just put the wedding dress in the little driver's seat and let it take me around. There's a metaphor for you. Who's driving this car?
Early in the book, you have a chapter called A Note on Foreshadowing. And I'm wondering if you could read this on page 23 so we could talk just a little bit about plot, because that was something, that idea of plot came back many times.
A Note on Foreshadowing. It's a mistake to think of one's life as plot, to think of the events of one's life as events in a story. It's a mistake. And yet there's foreshadowing everywhere. Foreshadowing I would have seen myself if I'd been watching a play or reading a novel, not living a life.
So can you talk about plot and how, you know, both craft-wise for memoir, like it is our life, it's not a plot. And you write later, like it's not about the plot, it's just about what it means. And why was this idea of plot so interesting to you that it was something you came back to throughout the book?
I think probably because I was approaching this book as a poet. So plot has not been on my list of things to make. Right? Like I haven't needed that. That's not been on my radar. You know, I'm not a fiction writer. I write poems, I write essays. And so going into this memoir, I realized, okay, so I'm having to tell the sort of story of my adult life. What does that look like? When I think about story, I think about that famous, you know, plot diagram of the, it looks like kind of like a steep mountain, right? Where we're kind of climbing up the rising action and then we hit this sort of peak crisis and then we have the following action and the resolution. And I was imagining, you know, being a Gen Xer, being an 80s kid and having the teacher kind of lay that transparency back when we used to have transparencies instead of smart boards, and would lay this transparency and would kind of draw in a marker, you know, and shine the light up to the front of the class. And in that way, I just kept thinking, this as a transparency, this rising action and this plot structure, I don't know how to overlay this or map this onto my lived life. Like it doesn't, lived experience does not feel as neat as writing the plot of a story. First this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. And then if we're lucky, they lived happily ever after. It just didn't feel that neat. So in the same way that I felt like the vignettes were the most psychologically true way of telling this story, I also really wanted to have a discussion with the reader about like, what am I doing here? Like, how do I tell you this story? I'm trying to tell you this story, but how do I do it? And to kind of show, you know, in The Wizard of Oz, you get to sort of peek behind the curtain and see the man working the levers. I wanted to show the reader behind the curtain of the writing process a little and say, hey, me to you, person to person, this is something I'm struggling with. Like, I'm not sure how to tell this story. I'm not sure where I am in the plot of my life. I'm not sure if it's even helpful to think of it that way, because this is a life, not necessarily a quote unquote story. And if it had been a book, like if I could step back objectively and read this experience like a book, the reader in me would have seen certain things coming. Because I think there is foreshadowing in our lives. You know, that's what we call red flags or little things that maybe we kind of shake off because we don't really want to look at them, or the sort of tiny cracks that can happen in a relationship that foreshadow the large the larger crack when they finally all meet and become something that is like a little larger than a small hairline fracture. But we're not invited to look at our lives that way unless we're writing about it. And so in some ways, writing it was a gift because it allowed me to look back and process some of what now I see as foreshadowing for some of what happened later.
Having looked at it this way through the lens of a writer and maybe coming to discoveries about those things, and maybe some of it is also just intuition, do you now approach your life with maybe a greater attention to those moments that could easily pass you by, but do you stop and linger and really investigate them more?
I hope I do. I mean, I'd like to believe that I'm a pretty attentive, attuned, and sensitive person. I mean, that's why I do what I do. I'm not sure I could be a poet if I weren't, you know, tuned in to like small changes and mundane moments and sort of like little sort of energy disturbances with people. I think I'm pretty attuned to them. But I also think that sometimes daily life can create a kind of override scenario for a lot of that attentive behavior, where if you're just sort of like in the weeds, parenting young kids, going to work, getting home in your routine, we can become a little dulled to some of those things. And I think I'm less dulled to it now. And in part because I'm in a new routine in a way, but I'm also out of a routine that I was in for many years.
Another element of the book that came back a lot, you had these pages that were incredibly short, and they were all called, a friend says every book begins with an unanswerable question. And then in the body of the page, you say, then what is mine? And throughout the book, you have different questions. Like in this one, it says how to set it down. There's others that might say like how to let it go or what does this mean? And they're throughout the book. So I'm curious about those unanswerable questions, both in your life and in the book as a craft device.
Yeah, I was doing an event. I think it was for Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures when Goldenrod, my book of poems, came out a couple of years ago. And I was in conversation with the writer Tiana Clark. And she said something during that conversation about books beginning with an unanswerable question. I remember jotting it down, you know, during our Zoom chat, because I thought, oh my gosh, that's so right. Like, that feels so intuitively right to me, that we are bringing, particularly to something like a memoir, we're bringing all of these big ideas, probably unsolvable mysteries, to this writing project. And the goal ultimately isn't necessarily to quote unquote solve or answer any of these things. It's to, you know, in the words of Rilke, like live the questions now. It's to live through the questions and really sit with them. And as far as craft, I mean, the first draft of this book had one chapter called A Friend Says Every Book Begins with an Unanswerable Question, Then What Is Mine? And it was a list of all the questions in the book. And Megan Steelstra, who I worked with really closely on this book as an editor, said, what would happen if you spread those out? What would happen if you pulled them apart and allowed them each a little bit more breathing room? They might be more powerful individually than they are when we get them all in a rush, because the reader doesn't really have time to sit and consider each question in the context of what might come right before it in the book and what might come right after it in the book. And I loved that. I loved that idea of making it yet another thread, so that when you reach that specific question, you know, what is mine, or how to remain myself, or how to heal, you're both considering what you just read in the page or two before. And then it's also informing, I think, what comes next. And so structurally, kind of deciding where I wanted those to go was another sort of piece of the puzzle. And I do think most of them are unanswerable. Not that they don't have many potential answers, but that they don't have one neat answer that will hold.
How much do editors influence your writing, and is it different between poetry and nonfiction?
Yeah, I don't actually, I haven't really had an editor, or at least at my publisher, do a lot of work on a poetry collection. I send the book and they're like, yeah, okay, that's the book. I do a lot of editing myself, and I send work to people I trust. So I have a couple of people that when I finish a poem, I send them the poem. Hey, what do you think? It doesn't mean that their feedback will necessarily make it into the final version of the poem, but I like not to work in an echo chamber. You know, I think it's good for us. No matter if we published 0 books or 7 books or 20 books, to be, you know, asking other people, what do you think about this? Am I in a rut here? Do you get it? Do you have questions? Is it satisfying? You know, what do you think? For nonfiction, I feel like I'm actually much more open to feedback and seeking a feedback because it's not my natural mode. You know, prose for me is, you know, obviously something I've been writing my whole life. We write prose as kids, but this book in particular was such a new project for me that I really did want to work closely with another writer on structuring it and thinking my way through the book. And so that's what Megan did for me.
And sometimes in the book, you step further away from who you are and create kind of a character for yourself. And that's when at times you're writing about all of this that's happening to you as a play, and you are the finder, and it's a with a capital F, and the characters are almost like very symbolic, like almost like Greek gods versions of the thing that they stand for and the thing that they're there for. So I'm curious about landing on this device and how it helped you maybe write more difficult scenes, or what role you wanted it to play on the page, but also as a thinker.
Yeah, I love that you're thinking about the Greeks, because I do think the sort of big the characters in that strand, it is kind of archetype, right? Like they're symbolic. They stand in for kind of roles that we play in life that are less individualized. The mother, the wife, the husband, the finder, the child. So it feels in some ways less intimate. And, you know, I mean, I say in the book, like, it's sometimes just easier to write about yourself as third person. Writing in first person, I, about things that are difficult or painful or vulnerable, feels different in the body than writing about it slightly distanced, held at arm's length, in a third person, slightly fictionalized way. And so it did, in a way, help me access some things that I felt like almost like oven mitts, you know, like the material was so hot that I needed a little bit of distance or a little bit of padding, a little bit of protection as a writer to give myself the permission to go to some of those places. Now, in a poem, the oven mitts might be form. Like, well, if I write it as a villanelle, it's structurally formal. And so it gives me a little bit of a distance. Or if I write about it in third person or second person, or even past tense is cooler than present tense, which is hot. So, you know, there are all these formal devices that we can use as writers to make ourselves more comfortable, I think, handling hot material. And that was one of the ways that I did it for myself in the book.
In a similar way to, or at least maybe a cousin of what you're talking about, is there's a part in the book, it's early on, and you had suffered a miscarriage. And you write, there's a difference between what is built in the body and what is built in the imagination. And what you were referring to was like you already were a mother of this child, even though it wasn't made physical, that what you create in your head was just as real for you. And the loss of that was just as real for you. And you were just kind of talking a little bit about embodiment and stepping away from that. And so I wanted to just follow up on this element of what is lived in the body and what is lived in the mind, because the same thing with your marriage, right? You thought you'd be together forever, and that was what you had. That was your vision.
Yeah. Yeah. What we build in our imaginations doesn't necessarily get built for real, right? Like that's a different thing. If we're lucky, it does. If we're lucky, it does. Or maybe if we just are really conscious about the way that we're building it and really attuned and really, you know, present. But yeah, it's heartening for me to hear that sort of metaphor came through for you in that chapter, that what we sort of project into the future with our imaginations and with hope, which is an imaginative force, right? Like when we're hoping, that's imaginative because we're seeing something in the future that's not there yet. That's different from reality. And we don't actually know what's there. I mean, one of the things I think a lot about is the future actually isn't any less defined now than it was for me 20 years ago. I just thought it was defined 20 years ago. You know, when I was married, I thought I knew what the future was, but it actually was as equally ambiguous and equally empty and equally up for grabs as it is right now. I just didn't have that awareness then. And so what I have now is an unclear future and an awareness that the future is unclear, instead of maybe a false sense of what I thought I was building in the future.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, it's also in a way that's really what you lost, because you can't ever grab the present. Like in a way you didn't lose the present because it's impossible to lose the present. The present is just happening. And so when you lost your marriage, you lost the whole imagination of what your life would be. I think we have a lot of lessons to learn about non-attachment and that we cannot control anything. And that is, I think, one of the scariest things of being human.
Oh, if not the scariest thing of being human. Yeah. Yeah. We really don't know. I mean, I really do think that with a whole lot of like naivete and optimism, particularly in our early lives, we believe that we can sort of set our life and then kind of copy paste it into infinity, into the future. Like, well, this year looks like this, so probably next year will look like this too. And then the next year will look like this. Well, I mean, if 2020 showed us anything, it's that we have no idea what the next year might look like. And it's incredibly scary to know how much uncertainty we actually are living with all the time without even being conscious of it. And the flip side of that is it's incredibly exhilarating how much uncertainty we live with.
One of the things you write in the very end, it's a quote from Rilke that I have never seen before, and it slayed me. Like, it brings tears to my eyes just thinking about it.
Oh, I know the quote.
Oh, my God. It says, "Let everything happen to you, beauty and terror. Just keep going. No feeling is final." And so that idea that we were talking about at the very beginning about where to start and end, it's like you want to end a memoir, but your life is still going and your feelings are not final.
No, they're not. And it's sort of maddening, right? In some ways, but also I find that quote so comforting and freeing, and sort of permission giving. It's actually written on a post-it note stuck to my office window, and it's been there for years, and it just lives there in my handwriting, and I see it every day. So if I ever need that reminder, it's just sitting there. No feeling is final is, to me, so comforting, particularly when the feeling is sad or angry or frustrated or disappointed or jealous or whatever the negative emotion is. It's so comforting, I think, when we realize that that's just a place where we're visiting for a time and we'll be moving through that, you know, and we may move through it quickly if we're lucky, that negative feeling. We may have to linger there for a while and sort of sit with it and not rush through it and let it spend its time and then move through it. But it's not where we live. Like, no individual feeling is where we live. It's just a place we're visiting. And in my sort of darkest moments, I really needed Rilke there to remind me that, okay, just keep going. This is not an end point. This is not final. This is not permanent. It will pass. It will pass.
I think it would also be very helpful when parenting kids going through this.
Yeah. I mean, because no 2 days are the same, right? Not for us and not for them. Like, we all have good days and bad days. And when I have a bad day, it's good for me to remember probably tomorrow will be better. And if it's not, probably the next day. You know, time has shown I can look back at my life and be like, actually, yeah, I don't usually have two really bad days in a row. And so if, you know, the past is some evidence of the future, I can gauge that there'll be an upswing. And the same with kids, you know, being able to bring that wisdom to them and just say, I know today is hard. Like, frankly, today kind of sucks. I hear you. We don't have to pretend it doesn't. I'm not going to tell you not to cry, not to be mad, not to feel your feelings. You get to feel it, all of it, beauty and terror. Rilke says so. But know that it's temporary, right? I mean, the sticking point of that is that sometimes joy can be temporary too. You know, we don't really get to keep a white knuckled hold on anything. All of it is fleeting. And in those cases, it reminds me to really savor the beautiful, bright moments, because those too will pass. That's how time works. We don't get to hit pause in that part of the story and just kind of live in the good times. We have to continue to cycle through. So that, I think that can help give us and our kids like greater appreciation for living in the present moment and enjoying that beauty when we have it.
I'm curious about how you vet this in the end. If your ex-husband had to read it, or like legal, like for people who are writing memoirs, how do they navigate that at the end?
Yeah, I think everyone probably handles it differently. Some people might have, I mean, I know people who have maybe written about their parents or written about a friend or a sister. And you might want to show the person the thing beforehand and just say, hey, are you cool with this? Like, are we still good? And there may be times when it doesn't actually make any sense to do that, because they probably would not be okay with it for obvious reasons. And in that case, it makes sense just to make sure that legally you're in good standing. And also, I mean, I will say personally, I knew going into this book that I was writing it with the right frame of mind and with the right, Like, I was coming to this book with a sense of curiosity, a sense of personal accountability. And really the kind of guiding principle for this book is love and not anger or any other sort of negative emotion. And I knew that if I kept sort of like my experience centered, my truth, only speaking for myself, and approaching it with a lot of sort of openness and compassion and curiosity, that I wouldn't get myself in the weeds.
Can you read a passage from an author that speaks to you or influenced you as a writer?
Yes. So picking something is really hard, but I found just a couple of paragraphs from this book is by Sarah Rule. She is a playwright, and this book is called 100 Essays I Don't Have Time to Write, and the subtitle is On Umbrellas and Sword Fights, Parades and Dogs, Fire Alarms, Children and Theater. And so these, this is just the last two paragraphs of this very brief essay. The essay itself is called On Interruptions, which people who are writers and parents have to contend with plenty of those. There was a time when I first found out I was pregnant with twins that I saw only a state of conflict. When I looked at theater and parenthood, I saw only war, competing loyalties, and I thought my writing life was over. There were times when it felt as though my children were annihilating me. Truly, you have not lived until you have changed one baby's diaper while another baby quietly vomits on your shin. And finally, I came to the thought, all right, then annihilate me. That other self was a fiction anyhow. And then I could breathe. I could investigate the pauses. I found that life intruding on writing was, in fact, life. And that tempting as it may be for a writer who is also a parent, one must not think of life as an intrusion. At the end of the day, writing has very little to do with writing and much to do with life. And life, by definition, is not an intrusion.
Can you talk about why you chose that?
Oh, I love this book so much. Actually, there's a quote from this book about narrative in the memoir. But I was thinking about how difficult it was for me after having kids to write again. The longest dry spell I ever had was the year after my daughter was born. I didn't write a poem for a year. And I talk about this in the memoir. It took me forever to finally get back to writing. And I mean, it was just logistically a nightmare. I was exhausted and she had colic and I had postpartum depression. And none of that was a great recipe for creativity. But also I didn't know what my writing was going to be. I just couldn't conceive with my daily life looking like it looked where the poems would go. You know, would I write poems about burp cloths and diapers and babies and missed naps? Like, what would my inspiration be? What was my material now? And how could I do it my way? And so it was really important to me when I got back to writing to seek out other mothers in particular who were writing, and particularly writing poems, and seeing the ways that they were still being so sharp and rigorous and strange in their sort of excavation of these seemingly mundane moments in life. And it gave me permission to do it myself. And so when I read that part of Sarah Rule's book, I was like, that I know. I'm constantly interrupted. And yet life is not an interruption. Life is not an intrusion on writing. But the best thing I can do as a person is be an integrated self. And that means not sort of dividing myself up into writer and mother or writer and woman, but allowing it all just to sort of be a whole.
Can you read a passage that you wrote? Maybe it changed a lot from the first draft or was difficult or something you liked.
This is just a little section of You Could Make This Place Beautiful. It's called The Poem. I have poems that have accrued over 8, 9, 10 years. Sometimes it feels like each poem I write is a draft of the poem I'm trying to write, that singular, golden, impossibly definitive poem, the one poem I'm trying to live, or the one life I'm trying to write, the mine. I've been testing out so many metaphors in this book, trying to find the perfect imagistic shorthand for this heart punch of an experience. The boat, the water, the nesting dolls, the ghosts, the scars. But this story isn't reducible to one. There isn't a singular, golden, impossibly definitive metaphor that encapsulates everything. No, it's all of them. I'm handing you a stack of Polaroids to shuffle in your hands. So some of the work is yours.
And tell me why you chose that.
So a big strand in this book, I forget what term you use, but I liked it for the italicized sections. That braid is sort of the metaphor section. And each of them begins how I picture it. And it's me trying to describe what this time of my life feels like using a metaphor, because I'm a poet. So that's how I make meaning. And so for me, this particular section of the book kind of helps the reader understand what I was going for with those. So if you get to this point in the book and that hasn't clicked or made sense to you yet, and I think this kind of writing happens throughout the book, where I want to sort of speak directly to the reader and just say, listen, I hope we're on the same page here, but in case we aren't, this is what I've been trying to do. And you're participating in this story. Like the way that I've structured this makes you do some of the work. Like you actually have to kind of show up and follow these strands, follow these breadcrumb trails. I can't do all the work for you, you know, just like in a metaphor, I can only kind of give you the comparison, but you have to kind of do the mental math to understand why one thing is like the other. Same thing with this. So I don't know, it felt kind of representative to me, both as a poet working a lot with metaphor and the voice of the book being a little bit more intimate, speaking directly to the reader.
Where do you write?
Mostly in this room. This is my writing room that used to be my children's playroom. And then I took it over. I reclaimed it. So this is where I do most of my writing. Although I am known in warmer weather to write on my back patio, where I can hear the birds and the wind and see the light coming through the leaves. And that seems to always be inspiring too.
What do you do, or where do you go to get away from writing?
You know, writing doesn't really feel like something I need to get away from. So I wouldn't say there's anything that I do as an escape from the thing I love doing. And there actually isn't a way to escape it, because even if I have no pen, no paper, no computer, no nothing, an idea will happen. Like even when I'm sleeping, ideas will happen. And that I'm just frankly grateful for. I hope the poems never stop knocking, even at seemingly inopportune moments.
Who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
Her name is Katie, the poet Catherine Pierce, my first friend I made in graduate school in the fall of 2000 at the Ohio State University. We became fast friends, and I still send her my poems now.
How have you dealt with rejection?
You know, I try not to take it personally. That's how I try to deal with rejection, because it still happens. I actually wrote about this fairly recently on my Substack in my newsletter, that it helps me to remember a couple of things. One, my work isn't for everyone, right? Like if you make anything of any artistic flavor, it's not going to appeal to every single person. You cannot be everything to everyone. And sort of along the same lines, editors are people. They're just human beings. And so when I send poems out into the world, if they're rejected, and still I miss more shots than I make, if they're rejected, it helps me to remember that they're not rejecting me as a person. They're not rejecting me even as a poet. They just didn't like those four poems that day. And it's not that the entire institution or magazine didn't like those four poems. It's that individual, probably one person, who has their own pet peeves and stylistic taste. It just didn't hit them and seem urgent and necessary to them on that day. But those four poems might really land with another human being on a different day, someplace else. And so not taking it personally and sort of like thinking the stakes are higher than they are helps.
And what is your favorite word?
I do not have one. I really thought about this and I thought, okay, I do have favorite vowel sounds. I love the bright vowels. So I love like I and A and E. I love an oo vowel, but there isn't one word that is my favorite. There just isn't. Like, I probably say the word love more often than I say any other word because I'm telling my children and everyone else constantly, I love this. I love that poem. I love you. I love that meal. I love this recipe. I love this song. I probably say love more than any other word. And that feels sort of like psychically right to me, but I don't love the sound of the word love. So it doesn't feel as good in the mouth as a word with a bright verb.
Thank you so much for your time and for having this conversation. I'm really grateful.
No, this has been lovely. And thank you for sort of thinking and feeling so deeply into the book. I really appreciate it.
If you like today's show with Maggie Smith, author of the memoir, You Could Make This Place Beautiful, check out my interview with Claire Dieterer, author of the memoir, Love in Trouble. We talked about how her book changed over time, reckoning with your teenage self and making some sort of peace that life will not give you what you want, and female friendship. You can find that interview in the entire First Draft archive of more than 400 interviews at firstdraftwriters.com. You can stay tuned to First Draft on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just look for First Draft ADOW. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com anytime. Remember, there are plenty of extras for becoming a member and donating to First Draft, including access to pitch-free, ad-free content, as well as cuts from the interviews that didn't make it into the final show, writing tips from my guests, books, and more. Join me as I reach for honesty, vulnerability, connection, curiosity, and insights on craft with each episode. I can't tell you enough how much each and every single dollar counts to keeping this show alive. The first tier of support is just $6 a month, so please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Coming up in the next few months on First Draft, interviews with Andrew Porter, Curtis Sittenfeld, and Mona Simpson. I want to send out a huge thank you to my patrons for making this interview happen. Your support makes First Draft, a dialogue on writing, a reality every week. Please stay healthy and safe. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Merv Mahaffey. I'm your host and producer, Mitzi Rapkin. Thank you for listening.